Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of the Psych Files, Psychology in Everyday Life. My name is Michael Britt, and today is Tuesday, December 18th, 2007. And the title for today's episode is How Big Is Your Office? A Classic Study in Psychology. Or for my college student listeners, how big is your dorm room? And what effect does that have on your productivity? This is an interesting study. This is about factors in the workplace that affect your productivity and your satisfaction with your job. And it was conducted back in 1988, conducted by Jerry Greenberg. And the study is called Equity and Workplace Status, a Field Experiment. Equity, of course, is fairness. And workplace status. So a couple things. One is I did an episode on equity, the concept of equity and fairness and how that affects us. And that was episode 15. It's just called It's Not Fair, Equity in Life and Work. Fairness, very important factor in our culture. And so this study was done in, of all places, an insurance company. So this is a field study. This is applied research. And, you know, they're hard to do because you have to find an organization that is or any setting that's willing to allow you to come in and do some careful research. So you're trying to apply some very methodical scientific procedures in a place that's very dynamic, the workplace. So you can study, and it has equity theory has been studied in college, you know, freshman classes, where you can bring in college students and ask them to, you can give them unfair amounts of chips, for example. And, you know, you can create inequity in a laboratory setting and see what happens. See if people are dissatisfied, if they don't have as many chips as the next person. And what do they do about it? Well, you know, that's a laboratory study that might be called basic research. And here we are, though, out in the real world. And so it's kind of fun to see how this really does affect us. So what did they look at? Well, they had this very unique opportunity, which I think is by itself amazing, that here's an insurance company, and they were going to be doing some refurbishing. So for this two-week period, 10 days, right, five work days, everyone was going to be reassigned, almost everyone, nearly everyone is reassigned to different offices. And we're dealing with 198 people. So it's a really good sample size. And these are underwriters. I've never been an underwriter, but they are people who look at and evaluate insurance claims. So some of them were going to stay in their offices. Some were going to be moved into offices that were pretty much the same way that their offices are now. And but a group of them were going to be reassigned to offices which were bigger and better than the ones they were currently in. And sure enough, there were others reassigned to offices that were not as nice as the offices that they were currently holding. So the question here is, when you are temporarily, even temporarily, moved into a higher status office, right? That, by the way, increases the denominator, I'm sorry, the numerator, the top part of your fraction. If you're temporarily even getting more outcomes, does that mean that you'll try to match that and become more productive? And what if, however, you are on the other side of the coin here, moved to an office that is actually, you know, it's smaller, it's not as nice of an office. What effect does that have on your productivity then? Will you become less productive, right? Will you do less in response to this lowering of your outcomes? So that's the question at hand. Now, it kind of interests me because recently I was, our location where I was working for my company was closed down. We were moved to a different location. And so I have about seven years into my organization, not really that long, although in an organizational setting, 7 years is kind of long. People don't stay at the job terribly long in many organizations. So I have some seniority, and in our small group, I have I was one of the earliest people in. So when there was talk about where we would move to and what our offices would be like, I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention. I assumed that I would have an office. You know, I didn't expect to have a fireplace or anything like that. I joked about that, but I didn't expect that. But, you know, an office with a door and you know, just something about equivalent to what I was in now. But, however, what I realized after we moved down there is that there was actually a great deal of talk about office space and a couple of factors that have to do with this. So this is actually, aside from compensation, these, what Greenberg in this article refers to as non-monetary outcomes, are very important. So I dug around a little bit over the past couple of weeks, and I asked around. I said, you know, what are the things that people were talking about? What are the issues here with offices? And I thought it was very interesting. Not only, we think about the size of your office, but there's actually a number of other factors. I don't know, maybe you're aware of them. Or, I wasn't. Didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to it. But if you think about, let's say, a corporate environment, although this happened actually when I was a professor, we also moved from one building to another, and there was a good deal of talk about who would get which office. So there's office size, but, well, let's start at the bottom. Think about maybe if I'd call it comfortable, but let's say the least prestigious kind of office you can have, and that would be a cubicle, right? Or they're lovingly referred to as cubies. So what is it? It's a space. It's not a very big space. The walls, right, you can move them. They don't go to the ceiling. There's no door. In the worst case scenario, you're in the center of a large room. You're not near a window. That kind of can't see out the window. You probably don't have a very big desk at all. So that's kind of a low status one. So how do you move up? What are the things that you can do to add some status to that? Well, you can move you closer to a window. That's seen as a higher status, that's more valuable. So the closer you are to a window is one way to reward you, I suppose, without increasing your money, your income, your compensation. Another thing you can do, moving closer to the window, is raise the walls up to the ceiling, and that gives you a greater degree of privacy. Now, we haven't given you a door yet. All we've done is raise the walls up to the ceiling. That would be the next step, give you a door. Having a door is a high-status thing. And then we get to things like the size of your office and the size of your desk, even in this case, is a non-monetary outcome. So these things are very careful. I was surprised a bit at how carefully these are tracked in this organization, in larger organizations, to make sure that people are properly compensated for their seniority and stuff like that. Okay, so here in this study, so we're in an insurance company, and we've got 190 employees being temporarily reassigned. So in comes Jerry Greenberg, and exactly how he made this arrangement, don't know. But what he says here is that they work together with management to set up a situation where they would study these group of people who are being reassigned for 2 weeks before the reassignment. During the reassignment, which, as I mentioned, is 10 days or 2 weeks again, and then 2 weeks afterwards. So this is what do we got there? I guess then we got the 4-6 weeks. And they're going to put the people into groups, the overcompensated. Now, what's interesting is that, you'd think you'd have three groups, really. You got the people who went to better offices, people who stayed in their office or went to a office that's very similar, and the people who went to a lower status office. But actually, he had six groups. Some of those offices were really very, very nice. So he called those people two steps overpaid. Some of the offices were very nice. That's one step overpaid. Then you've got your control group, this condition, right? In this situation here, we have people, as I said, who stayed in their office, so they're the control group, or went to an office that's equal. And then you've got your one step underpaid. Even though this doesn't have to do with pay, it has to do with non-monetary, quote-unquote, pay, if you will. So they're one step underpaid, so the office is not so nice. And then two steps underpaid, the office is really significantly not as nice as what the person came from. All right, so there's the manipulation, if you will. We call that the independent variable. That's what we're going to put people into those groups and see what happens to their productivity. Now, there is the tricky part, productivity. We talk about that. Okay, we're going to measure their productivity. And you can say that, but it's hard to measure productivity. I mean, think about the productivity of, and this is the difficulty of doing any kind of field experiment. How productive is someone who has a, whatever, let's say a job where you deal with the public. So suppose you deal with customer service. How do you measure whether someone is very good at customer service? If you really wanted to measure it, right? I mean, we sort of know, oh, that person's good. They have the right personality. Well, what do you mean by that? And how do we measure that? Are there things we can observe that that person does? Oh, well, that person, well, she smiles a lot, or he, you know, smiles a lot. Well, so, you know, okay, that's good. Now, if I'm going to do a study, though, I have to be able to count that. So do I count the number of smiles? That sounds kind of silly. It could be done, though, although, you know, then you have to define that. What's a smile? Right? These are all the things. It's crazy, isn't it? But these are the things you got to think about if you're going to do a scientific study. If you're going to look at behavior externally, right, which is what probably Skinner would like, then how are you going to, what they call in the scientific method, observationally define the productivity of a customer service person? Number of smiles. Well, that could be one, right? Typically, what you're going to try and do is measure a number of things and combine them, if you can, into one overall. So you might do, for example, well, there are customer service satisfaction surveys. That's one. You could give a survey to the people who you serve and ask them to evaluate how their general satisfaction with some of the employees. But then you get problems. I mean, how do you? Some people are work there longer or are more exposed to the public. Some are. Don't work as many hours, so how do you deal with that? Number of times that someone is that someone talks to the manager and says, "Hey, that person's great." No, that doesn't really happen that often. But, you know, during what? This study was done over 6 weeks, which is a goodly amount of time. What if nobody says anything? What if no customer says anything positive during that time? It is really hard to get some measure of this thing we call productivity when you're in the quote-unquote, the real world. So how do they do it here? Well, that's another thing that makes this study a classic. He did, a really good job of defining the productivity. Okay, now, so he's not, luckily, not dealing with customer service. So the job is, a bit more, a little easier to measure here because these people are actually producing a product. For example, if you worked on an assembly line, it'll be kind of easy, well, to a certain extent easy to measure the number of widgets you create. That would be your productivity. Although even that is affected by perhaps other people on the assembly line, right? Okay, so these people read, as I mentioned, they evaluate insurance claims. Okay, so then why don't you just measure the number of insurance claims they complete every day? And you can measure that before the study starts, right? So you get in, well, this person evaluates an average of, 18, well, maybe a lot. Let's go with 6 insurance claims a day. And then during the study, they evaluate more or they evaluate less on average. So the number of insurance claims that they process per day could be considered a reasonable dependent variable here, or measure of productivity. Although someone would then argue, well, yeah, but, you know, you've never done insurance, you're like me, you've never done insurance claim evaluation, but I can easily imagine that some of them are more complex than others are. So you could spend on one day, perhaps the entire day, evaluating that claim, which means you only got one done, but it was a really hard one. So how do you deal with that? I mean, do you walk away and say, oh, forget it, this is impossible? Well, you have to be a little bit creative, and I think that's what they were here. They asked experts to measure to look at each one of these claims and evaluate its complexity. So if it's a complex one, the person got a few more points for dealing with that one. So you're going to adjust – this measure here of the number of insurance claims done per day by the complexity of it. And so, you know, this that's one of the things they did. You know, I don't want to go into the entire study because it's not complex. I don't think it's – that's the thing. I don't think it's terribly complex. I think it's – but there are some more details to it. But that's primarily it. So we'll look at productivity by looking at the number of claims processed per day. So here's the question then, as I mentioned, just to restate. If you were moved to a higher status office, it's bigger, there's windows, a bigger desk, are you going to work harder? Are you going to process more claims than someone who's moved to a lower status office? And they also looked at job satisfaction. So they measured people on the infamous Minnesota job satisfaction questionnaire, one of those rating scales. Well, what's cool about this is the results, as I mentioned. So 2 weeks beforehand, before anybody was moved to their different offices, the 2 weeks beforehand, everyone had relatively non-significant difference in their productivity, right? So in this case, by the way, we've got, as I mentioned, there are six groups. And so in this case, they did statistics. They did an F test. And just for those of you who are interested, which is probably not very many, and there is that is a between subjects, and that would be non-significant. So between the groups, no significant difference before this two-week period begins. Then what happens during the 2 weeks? Well, as you might predict, what's really interesting is that the productivity diverges sharply. So, but in some ways you would predict, and in some ways you wouldn't. Do the people in higher status offices, are they more productive? The answer is yes. So if they were really overcompensated, if they really got a really nice office, for the first week, they were very productive, the most productive. A nice office, not the greatest, but a nice office, were they more productive? Yes. Not as productive as the really nice offices, but they were productive, more so than the 2 weeks beforehand. The people who stayed in their offices kept that same level of productivity, right down the middle. Right? If you were moved to an office that wasn't so nice, did your productivity fall? Yes. If you were moved to an office that really stunk, did your productivity fall? Yes. That's the lowest. Okay, that's week one. What happened in week two? Well, these numbers changed a little bit. The people who were in the really low status offices stayed low in their productivity. And so did the people who were in the not so nice. So the people who were undercompensated, if you were moved to a really bad office, you were not productive. What's interesting is what happened in the people who moved to the nice offices. Remember I said that if you were moved to a really nice office, you were the most productive? Well, by week two, you started to decrease your productivity a little bit to about the same level as the people who were moved to a nice office. Still above those who stayed where their offices were. But the thing is, what's interesting about this and what it points out is that we can tolerate overpayment. Right? It's kind of cool at first, and you might work a bit harder. But after a while, you know, you're like, yeah, okay. You sort of go back to where you were. But if you were really underpaid, that stinks. And you lower your productivity as a result. So that's about the extent of the study that I want to go into. Just that it's just the results were just ideal, and that's what made it real. I think an interesting study, and it reflects what I've seen in my work environment. That people who were moved to offices that weren't so nice, that's upsetting. It really is, and we are very sensitive not just to our pay, which after a while we adjust to, I think. It's just like, okay, you've been paid this for so many years, but to the other factors around us. And not dissimilar to college students who are moved into dorms. And, of course, freshmen have the crappiest dorms and the seniors have the nicest ones, and that's understandable, right? So not so nice when someone who's a freshman gets moved for some reason into a nicer dorm, right? There's inequity, and that makes us uncomfortable. All right, so there you go, classic study, if you will, and if everyone agrees with me. And so finally, I just wanted to end up with the email from a listener named Ben, who was listening to a previous episode, and it was the episode on EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, in which I interviewed a woman who does that type of therapy. And basically what he's saying is that, you know, that there is some controversy surrounding EMDR and its effectiveness. And I did not, in that interview, discuss that with her. I didn't confront her with that and say, well, you know, what about your critics, the critics, not her critics, but the critics who say the EMDR, this and that. And, you know, why not? Why didn't I confront her? Although he said that, listen, I understand, you know, this is someone who agreed to do an interview, and this is not 60 minutes. So I'm not going to start attacking someone during an interview when I actually am happy that they are willing to sit down and give the interview. And prior to the interview, I did some research and found that, many sources that suggested that EMDR is effective, particularly with what's called civilian trauma. So, but, you know, did I give equal time to, because in this podcast, I definitely do want people to be critical. In fact, I had an episode on that, which I'll link to as well, about critical thinking and the overflowing cup, I think it was called. So I want people to be critical thinkers. And so what he's suggesting is that, is there a part two? You know, is there any time you're going to actually talk about what the critics say about EMDR, and that is a worthwhile thing to do, and I agree with him completely. And so I'm going to look into this a bit further and discuss some of what people are saying about EMDR and what the responses to that are, because I think that, as I say, I do agree with him that it's important to look at both sides of this and at least understand it and realize that it's out there. Okay, so I thank him for that email, and do feel free to come to the site or just send me an email, michael@thepsychfiles.com, and send me an email, let me know what you think. All right, there you go. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and we are getting near the holidays, so I hope you're having good holiday time. I know I mentioned I was going to talk about stress, but I'm finding it is such a busy time that it's difficult to get the episodes out as frequently as I would like, but I'm going to give that a shot, try to get another episode out before the end of the month. So again, thank you for listening. See you next time on The Psych Files. Have a good week.